Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Spanners. Ready? Thanks for sticking with us in the off-season. We are going to bring you the best off-season content we can possibly muster. And this week, we're going to be talking some engineering. We're going to talk some contract law. And we're going to get some listener feedback from you guys as well. So me and Matt will be in the shed here talking about some of the correspondence we've received from you. Before that, we're going to talk about Lewis Hamilton's contract negotiations, what Sergio Perez can expect at Red Bull, given that he's only on a one-year contract. And we'll talk a little bit about the tracks and the contracts they have during 2021 and trying to adjust around this global pandemic and the surprises that the schedule throws up. Before that, though, to start the show off, we're going to be talking to Stuart Mitchell from Race Car Engineering Magazine, and let's bring you that interview right now. And I'm delighted that we are joined in the shed by Stuart Mitchell from Race Car Engineering Magazine. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning to you guys. How are you doing?
Very polite of you to not correct me, because we are recording this in the afternoon on the 12th of January, but we won't be focusing too much on any current or breaking news. Delighted that you're joining us back in the shed again to add to our armory of tech news. And I guess we'll start by getting your views on these outgoing 2020 cars. As Matt was pointing out to me earlier, you know, these could be the fastest ever F1 cars in history and the fastest F1 cars we're going to see for some time.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And the when you look back at 2020, obviously, it was a very compressed schedule and all of that. But the guys, they came out, they gave us an awesome show at every single track that we went to. And the cars are just blisteringly fast now. And interestingly, they've been as close as they have been for many, many years as well. So throughout the 20 cars on the grid, they've been within about 3.5% of nominal pace throughout the whole season. So it's pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, and from a racing point of view, we've gone through an era where everyone has complained about these large cars, these hybrid cars. They're too fast, they're too cumbersome, and they can't race. And we've had a season where, despite Lewis Hamilton going off and claiming his 7th world championship, #44, #GOAT, the racing has been fantastic. I know he dominated the championship, but from a wheel-to-wheel point of view, we've had hardly any tracks or racing where it's been a procession and no one can get by and no one can race, which is just counterintuitive, even on the old school tracks, even at Portimao, Mugello, well, forget about Imola. But generally, we could race these cars, Stuart.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually, it's sort of a twofold thing, because one is that, of course, these cars are just getting better and these guys are designing elements of the car to behave better in traffic as well. They're starting to learn more about it. But also, with a compressed schedule and a lower number of races overall, every point and every opportunity is worth that little bit more, obviously as a percentage of overall number of races. So when you've got only a handful of races to actually make the difference, you're going to push that a little bit faster and you're going to push a little bit harder throughout that weekend. And you'll see the guys going wheel to wheel and they want it more.
Okay, so I'm a little bit curious now. Talking about specifically the midfield, because I know you say like 3%, but you're that 3%, that encompasses Mercedes to Williams, right?
That's right, yes.
But if I looked at, let's say, position 6 to position 12 in the midfield, has it ever been that close? Because to me, that was where the most amazing things were happening in the racing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So that so-called midfield, which includes the likes of from Alfa Romeo all the way up to, say, some of the other guys around that, the Haas, the Williams, you know, these guys, albeit them being, say, 3 or 3.5% behind Mercedes, they're actually only about 0.75% between each other. So if any one of those teams' nominal output over a course of a weekend drops to 99.24%, they've lost a place. And 99.24 is pretty close to 100%. So that's the margin of error that they've got to work in between, you know, taking their place or 3 or 4 or 5 spaces, in fact, to losing it all.
Is it something inherent about the current regulations? I mean, when we look at like data points, it's sometimes useful to just take away the top and the bottom. So if we take away Mercedes and we take away, say, the Haas.
Take away
Max and the Mercedes and take away some of the bottom cars as well and focus in on that midfield. Is there something inherent about this season's regulations that has allowed such a tight midfield battle?
Not specifically this season. It's been so the regulations have been what they have been since the 2017 changes. So it's been an evolution since then. So 2017, they had the change of bodywork that made for the wings that we've got now, for the front wings that we've got now, and just lots more scope. So this is just people learning a lot more about how to get their car behaving the way they want it, and also taking more risks as well in terms of aerodynamic stability and sensitivities across the car, because they know that those risks will pay off if everything all stays in place, for example. So it's a very, very challenging set of conditions in that midfield because those guys have got to take more risks. But the rewards, like I said, because only 0.75% difference between them are huge if they make 1% or 2% gain.
Yeah, it's good. And so what we ended up seeing, Matt, was we would see different teams kind of pop up to that best of the rest tag and be fighting for the podiums. I mean, how many podium finishes did we have this season? 84 different podium finishes, I think.
Was it that?
It was quite a lot.
84? Well, 100, 1,000. Now, can I ask real quick, looking back at other regulatory eras, it often turns out that there are unintended consequences to the changes they make that allow the teams, one team, like, you know, obviously everyone thinks immediately of sort of Braun and the double diffuser, but it seems like there were some areas of the car that were left out of the usual bounding that occurs in the regulation set. And do you think it was that maybe contributed to why the teams were able to get closer with such a diversity of design?
There is and there isn't. The boxes were rather large compared to what they were like before. So, for example, the space behind the nose of the car that runs down towards the front floor, there you'll see a lot of what's called the skirt design coming on board many of these cars. And that, for example, was an area that was left free in the regulations that slowly was adopted by various teams. And that makes a huge difference for the onset conditions, for the barge boards, as well as what the air going underneath the floor, for example.
Would you mind just explaining boxes for me? Sorry, Stuart. Would you mind explaining boxes? When you say boxes, are these like 3D geometric spaces in which they're allowed to operate? So I guess some will be red, you can't touch it. Some are green and you can.
Essentially, yeah, absolutely that. So you have the cars all have a very generic shape that looks very similar because they fit within those boxes. So the wings are the same size, for example. But when it comes to the boxes that have freedoms in them, So the barge border area has a lot of freedoms. You can manipulate the geometries and the shapes and the sizes of things quite a lot. And that gives you the opportunity to develop your own philosophy for how the car should perform in those areas.
I just love the concept of these engineers, you know, looking at the green areas that they're allowed to build on and really going mad. Reminds me of a Friends episode. They were trying to stop Phoebe from ruining the party with her organization. So they said, well, you're in charge of cups. So she took that small area and she made a whole cup themed party and went mad. Like with the Winglet Wars of, like, I'm trying to think of like 2006 kind of era, was it? Where, what happened there? Because they tried to restrict aero, but then they left gaps in the regulations, which meant these tiny mini wings were just popping up everywhere.
Yes, yeah. Well, when you go back to those sets of regulations, they actually had, it was actually bizarre because obviously they had the width of the wing was limited.
Yeah.
But what you could do within the two barriers was basically free. So you didn't have a Y250, for example, which is the space between the actual loaded planes on the front wings that we have now. There was opportunity to get downforce from absolutely everything. And that's where sort of the nostrils popped up on, for example, the BMW. And some, I think the McLaren actually had some nostrils as well. Ferrari didn't, but they had some other tricks going on back then. So there was a lot of different philosophies going on in that space. You give people freedom, give them an inch, they'll take a mile.
And obviously F1 engineers, very clever people, don't seem to care at all what the car looks like. It is simply the shape. And if it looks like an unwieldy bat wing, or in Caterham's 2014 case, an aid of some sort, a personal aid, then they don't mind at all. They don't care at all. Now, last week we had Alex Brundle on. And he proposed, and I don't want to spend too long on this, but he proposed, we asked him what areas of F1 would you get rid of? And he said, no aero above the floor. So he said, you can get lots of efficient aero above the floor. Obviously, the aim is to not affect the car behind. But I was thinking about it as I slept on it, and I thought, well, if you say, okay, all your downforce has to come from the floor, we would get the most bizarre floors in F1 history. Like, they would go mad creating things.
They would, absolutely. And this is where the argument of 2022 comes along, because the amount of energy that the floor should be able to generate in terms of downforce is significant. So if you're going for a floor-specific car, you need to keep that platform absolutely perfect, or as close to perfect as you possibly can. But they're also banning things like hydraulically interlinked suspension, which at the moment is actually critically important to keep the car's platform absolutely stable so that all the aero was working. So suddenly you're going to have a car that's behaving very, very differently, and also having this dependence on the floor, which will change things up quite a lot.
Okay, I want to dig into that a little bit if I can. I know they got rid of, they banned Mercedes Frick, and that was a front rear interconnection of the hydraulically interlinked systems to keep the platform stable.
Yeah.
But you're saying that it's still allowed on either the front or the rear axle. I thought Red Bull had reverted to Belleville springs, but they're still using a hydraulic heave damper. Is that correct?
So this is where it gets a little bit more complicated. So when you talk about Frick, you're absolutely right that Frick in its previous incarnation has been banned in that specific layout. But you can still use hydraulics to control roll from left to right. So they have hydraulic dampers now that actually obviously maintain the platform front and rear, side to side. And that's what will be banned. So they'll have to have each corner operating completely independently.
Wait a minute. So this hydraulic system wasn't that effectively active suspension then?
It's a passive way of actively controlling the suspension.
That make sense. A passive way of actively controlling it. Let's go back to the Williams, I think, in the early 90s that had the active suspension. So,
yes.
So the idea is basically as the car's rolling, you will mechanically underpower right the car so that it stays flat and therefore the aero works properly. I think I've got the idea there. And it was Nigel Mansell's car, wasn't it?
It was.
And he said it was just incredible to drive and actually hard to drive, because I guess you can then use all the downforce and go ever faster. were the cars, when you talk about the cars using this kind of passive active suspension, which I still don't get as a phrase, were they getting close to that kind of effect? It was really improving the aero and downforce through the corners.
Yes, well, that's what they have. They have now is it's a hydraulic unit that basically connects the left and right hand sides of the suspension.
Yeah,
and so once you, as you're steering towards the left, it will load up the right hand side, and that will try to maintain the platform stable.
I'm assuming what makes it not active suspension is it's using some existing motion of the car to load up the side that they want to load up under more pressure.
Yes, it's not a system that's actively preloaded or electronically controlled or anything like that. It uses the hydraulic system on board the car that is mechanically influenced.
So it's almost accidental. It's like, oh, the hydraulic pressure just built up on the right hand side, making the suspension more stiff on that side.
For example, yeah. But it's usually for damping control rather than sort of trying to add stiffness to that corner, for example.
Okay, and that's going to go away. So what are we going to see when it goes away?
Conventional suspension, so to speak. as Formula One, will attack it. It won't be conventional, of course, but it will just mean that they will have to pay a lot more attention to the design of each corner. Because they won't have this interaction to take care of behaviors that otherwise wouldn't be able to be controlled.
All right. I'm now going to ask the kind of question that I become either famous or infamous for, depending upon who you are.
17 pot.
Currently, to be clear, I can link the left and right corners either at the front or at the back hydraulically so that they can influence each other as I'm going through a turn.
Yes, that's right.
In the 2022 regulations, I'm not allowed to do that, but I would still be able to use, for example, hydraulics for my bump and my damp, but I just can't connect them across the axle, or it's all got to be mechanical. There's no hydraulics at all.
Well, from what I've read, and these are just what the FIA have released at this stage. And that the interlinking of suspension to control platform, i.e. to try to keep the car flat, will no longer be allowed in the same format that it exists already, which is a link between the left and right-hand sides or the front and the rear, depending on throttle or brake pressure, for example. Things like that can no longer be manipulated. So anti-dive geometries will have to be built into the suspension geometry itself rather than relying on hydraulics to maintain that platform under braking, for example.
And there's one more element. There's a bump, there's a damp, and then there's also Formula One runs with a heave element as well. And is that also going to be required to be mechanical, or are they going to be able to use a hydraulic heave element, or have they not? Or are you not sure yet?
I'm not entirely sure how the final set of regulations will turn out. But what they don't want to do is they don't want people spending the kind of money, time, and effort to try to keep the platform as flat as it is now. They want that to be left to the driver. And so when a racer is driving any other type of race car that doesn't have this sophisticated interlink system, what happens is they have to control the behavior of the car under braking, through the corner, and under acceleration as well. So they can't rely on the car to maintain the platform where they can just absolutely bury it, for example, right, so to speak. So they will have, it will be left up to the drivers to manage the behavior of the car a lot more.
So how much you get on the power is going to affect the, I always forget between like pitch and yaw, what's the side-to-side one? If I'm dipping a wing, which
that's roll.
That's roll. Okay. So I have to think about the roll, because the less roll I have, the more my downforce is going to be working. The more I pin it and lean on the tires, do I lose effective downforce? Is that what I'm fighting against as a driver?
Yeah. So what you need to for all of the aerodynamics to work, really and truthfully, you need straight ahead air that's nice and clean.
Right.
So you need to be out there by yourself, essentially, and you need to not turn the steering wheel. And I know that might sound bizarre, but
yeah,
that's the optimum condition, of course, for all of the aerodynamics across the car.
Yeah.
And so you actually want the car to be in a straight line for as long as possible, which means that when you're cornering, you don't really want to be carrying loads of yaw or carrying loads of roll or anything like that, because your aerodynamic platform is just not working. And for these cars, for example, now in 2020, the cars are super sensitive to this. And that's why what happens is you see a car that's super loaded up, and then for whatever reason, it seems to just snap and just pirouette off into the sunset.
Right.
That's because these cars are ultra sensitive aerodynamically. And they reach that threshold. Once you break that threshold, there's no coming back from it. Well, they're trying to reduce that.
Okay.
And they're also trying to slow down the cars a little bit as well, which is a side effect of not being able to keep that platform.
So Matt's going to ask an interesting question. I'm going to just slightly interrupt to dumb it down again. You mentioned you don't want too much yaw. So that is whether the car in the same horizontal plane is like pointing left or right.
That's right. Yes.
Okay, good. So if you were sliding, then you've changed your yaw. So if you're slightly hot or slightly oversteery into a corner, suddenly you haven't got the straight on air anymore, even though you're traveling mm-hmm. forward. So your downforce is compromised, and this is what's causing that kind of that snap, or contributing to that snap. But that is fascinating. I'm really glad I've just got this opportunity to sit with an expert and like dumb it down to my level. Sorry, Matt, continue to take it up to a level our listeners are more comfortable at.
Well, no, I just wanted to ask a clarifying question, which is essentially what you're saying is the 2022 platform. And boy, do I have so many questions, the more I think. The 2022 platform essentially is looking to give the driver a longer transition before the car has that snap. In other words, it should give them, relative to the very, very sensitive aero that they have now, where you're loaded up, and then it's gone too quickly to catch. The idea is to give them a little more of a gentle glide path or a transition, so the driver can make more of a difference in those turns.
Or is that just an accidental consequence of taking away this active hydraulic suspension? Active, passive?
It is and it isn't. That's not just suspension. In fact, it's very little to do with suspension when you talk about the onset conditions of aero onto the car. So if you're in yaw, it doesn't matter what suspension you have, your car doesn't work.
Right, yeah.
So principally what they want to do with these, by lowering the overall downforce potential, you reduce the overall sensitivities, or the potential of sensitivities as well. So if you go towards a tunnel-based system, i.e. the floor working harder to actually make the overall downforce, you are less sensitive to the car in front, for example.
Gotcha.
Because
right.
The car in front pretty much only disturbs, or most of the disturbance comes on the surfaces of the car. So
cool.
That's where that changes.
Right. We're going to move on to a term that you mentioned in our little WhatsApp group chat that neither me or Matt understood at all. But first of all, I would like to be nosy and ask you what's going on in the world of Race Car Engineering magazine. Now, your title is the deputy editor, is it not?
That's right, yes.
Okay, so your job is to usurp the existing editor and take over eventually. But whilst you're doing your bidding for your general, what is Race Car Engineering up to at the moment? What can we expect?
We've just launched the February edition of Race Car Engineering, which has an awesome feature on the McLaren MCL35. And that takes all of 2020's, all of the investigations that we did in 2020. So everything from Barcelona testing to the very last race. So that really dives deep into the story of 2024 McLaren and their sort of, quote, game of inches approach that I call it, which is step by step by step by step, making those improvements to the point where they took third in the championship.
Well, I was going to ask the motivation. Is it because they have such a good story of climbing back to third, or is it because from an engineering point of view, they've got a particularly interesting approach that you focused on it?
It's both. So they had an interesting approach, but that approach was also partially forced by the FIA. Because 2020 was so bizarre, we had so many races in such a short time. The FIA were telling people to homologate stuff left, right, and center at specific times. So as much as it was part of McLaren's strategy to have this sort of game of inches approach, it also was forced by the FIA, which meant that they, for example, turned up at Mugello with a wing that wasn't really ready for the rest of the car. and then they had to bring the rest of the updates for Germany, for example.
That. Yeah, so I remember that the talk of them having an upgrade and it disappearing.
Yeah, and it was, I think, even more complicated because they were going to lots of tracks where they don't have much historic data to use as comparison, and at times when they're normally not there.
Yeah, absolutely. That made a big difference. And if you look at, for example, Germany, I mean, an F1 car has never really been characterized to work in the rain, in the wet, for at 11 degrees Celsius. So it's as much as they have the capacity to cope with that, it was very much a case of, right, whoever stays on the track and points it in the right direction will be able to keep it going. And obviously traction was an issue there as well. So yeah, it was a very bizarre one because, and also the tires are an interesting one in those kind of conditions, because if you get through your rubber, you then don't have any capacity to maintain heat in the tire. So yeah, as you reduce the amount of rubber that's remaining, the sensitivity of the tire goes up. So you actually have to drive even harder and you're reducing grip because you've got less rubber. So you end up in this spiral basically to try to keep the tires on. And those who manage to keep them on for a little bit longer than everybody else managed to keep it in the right direction.
That typing you can hear is Matt trying to get his credit card details in for a subscription to Race Car Engineering Magazine. The notes will be in the show notes and should be below the video as well if you're watching the video. How does it work, Stuart Mitchell? Because do I have to go to a shop? Do I need to go to WH Smith's? Is that still a thing? Is that still open?
Yeah. It is still open. Yeah. Pretty much every WH Smith across the UK will have Race Car Engineering on their shelves. And sell it directly from the website.
And you personally hand deliver it as well. So that's good. That's a bonus.
Yes, of course.
Fantastic. Well, go and check out Race Car Engineering magazine. Now, Matt, you are going to ask him about a question you failed to Google. Googling let you down.
I did not fail to Google it. I Googled it and did not find an answer that was satisfactory. And yes, I'm ignoring the tires despite my predilection. But you said that James Key was using this term driver resolution. And I'm assuming that has got nothing to do with photographs. What exactly do you think he means by that?
So driver resolution is a concept that is quite hard to describe and even harder for the drivers to explain to their engineers as well. But essentially, you get to a point where you're driving the car on instinct. You're no longer getting the feedback necessary for you to make calculated decisions to drive the car. And that is a sensation that can be derived from problems with the car in terms of its setup, for example. You're just not feeling what you need to feel coming through, but it's also a function of the speed of these cars. And so now that we're in the third generation of this set of regulations with the aero that we've got now and so on and so forth, these cars are just so fast to the point where the drivers lose this resolution and through the high speed corners and just go on instinct.
Right. So if I may propose an analogy, it's like when your hand falls asleep and then you reach and try and grab, you just can't feel anything. So what you're saying is that the information coming through the steering column, coming through the bottom of the car, through their seat, is coming too fast for them to process it. So the car starts to feel numb to them. And they can't rely on what they're feeling to help them get through corners, to help them with braking and stuff like that. It all has to either be pre-calculated or cross your fingers and hope you don't bend it.
Yeah, it's more of a function of the speed of all of those things rather than the cars being sort of insensitive, for example. So when you get in there, it will give you tons of feedback because of how, say, quote, tight the whole car is. But in this case, it's just the speed. The speed of all these corners are coming at you, and of course you're battling on track. The drivers actually have to just go on instinct in some of these cases because the cars are just that fast. So certainly through the high speed stuff, you're holding your breath, trying to steer at the same time in some cases. So these guys are going through a pretty tough time.
Right. So I'm presuming he's not going to be mentioning this unless he thinks he has some kind of a solution for it. What And now, obviously, it's going to be not a problem into 2022 and even probably not into next season. But what approach were they taking to help their drivers with that?
Well, it's taking those drivers up to that next level of elite athlete. They're all pretty good at it already. That's not to say that there isn't anything that else that could be done. Of course, racing drivers have a tough time in Formula One cars. So they just need to work a little bit harder to try to get these guys to be able to take the abuse that these cars are giving them. But next year, the cars will be slower. And obviously the year after that, we'll bring in a brand new set of regulations for the chassis and the aero design. So realistically, it's going to go down from here, but it's impressive to hear the likes of James Key, who obviously his two drivers are Carlos Sainz and Lando Norris. Not necessarily struggling. I wouldn't say struggling because it's not just them. It's everybody on the grid, but reaching the threshold of what human beings can pedal around a racetrack, really.
That's actually pretty phenomenal when you think about it from a technological point of view. Because then what do? Once it gets to the point where, you know, there's only so far that we can just improve training. At some point, we just have to go, well, no, it's either AI or we just go back to more simple systems, slower cars.
Yeah, well, that's obviously the solution that the FIA are looking into and everything like that is the latter. But realistically, you know, when you think of the likes of these 20 guys that drive around these tracks in these cars, if they aren't the best at what they could possibly do and try to keep this car on the track and not lose resolution, then who is, kind of thing? You know, like you said, are we going to end up with a super soldier kind of driver, an AI type robot thing, some sort of Terminator behind the wheel? I don't know, but these guys, we're getting to that threshold where humans just can't control these things at that kind of speed, or we're getting up there to that limit where the resolution is lost.
And then, Matt, that talks about basically what is the soul of F1 as a sport? What do we want? Yes, we always want an engineering challenge, but we definitely don't want to lose that human element where the driver is just ballast and we have to give him ever-increasing tools and sensitivity to handle what is essentially a rocket launch.
Yeah, well, what I find fascinating is the speculation always was, and you can go all the way back, and it's always the FIA gets concerned, the car's too fast, it's going to be too dangerous, we need to slow them down. Sometimes they have a good approach to that, other times they just take a chainsaw to your floor, like they did in the 90s, and mess everything up for everybody. But what's interesting to me is that it was always, to me, G-forces that were ultimately going to limit how fast these cars were going to go. But now, hearing you say that, I think it might not. It might be the actual human processor just will not be quick enough before we get anywhere near that G-force limit through corners.
Yes and no. Obviously, there's techniques and technology out there to help people deal with G-force. So there have been discussions in the past about racing suits, including things like pressure gauges and pressure systems on board to try to keep the blood flowing where it needs to flow to keep these drivers turning the steering wheel when they need to. Those kind of discussions came and went when drivers basically took driving more seriously and sort of worked on the human element of performance. We're just getting to that threshold now where it's just the sheer amount of information that these guys are trying to process, coming through their eyes and through the gearbox, the feeling, the sensations, the vibrations, steering, everything like that. And it's all happening very, very quickly. So through the high speed stuff, you'll hear sometimes these drivers will lose resolution, and they all have their codes about what's going on inside the car. Mm-hmm. And there's only so much technology that can bring them back past that, back from that threshold.
Well, wonderful to have you on, and absolutely fantastic to be producing content with Race Car Engineering Magazine. And we hope that we can get you back on not too far into the future, because I would love to just get a specific take on how we think the world is going to shape out in the world of 2021 regulations. But just in brief, you know, having a look at where we've come from and where we're going, we're going to see in 2022. An era of the drivers suddenly having a different role to 2020. And it's going to be interesting to see, I think, which drivers can handle that. I think we're going to be surprised if we see our current crop of drivers in what sounds like a very different challenge?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be very, very different for so many different reasons. So in the same way that someone who drives a GT car jumping into a formula car that's so aero-dependent needs to change their driving style, well, these two different types of aerodynamics will have a very different approach to driving style as well. They'll be less sensitive to being in traffic, for example.
Yeah.
So it's going to go down from 50% loss of overall downforce or aerodynamic efficiency, should I say, to about 10% loss. So that's going to make a massive difference. So you're going to see these guys approaching each other much quicker. They'll be making moves earlier like they did back in the day. So we'll see a lot less of the DRS based overtaking that seems to take forever to do. So should be all good. Should be interesting.
I was actually going to ask the moment you said that, in the old days, they used to tune the DRS when they would show up in practices. Is that something you think might happen even next year as we have sort of this, hybrid regulation on the way to 2022? Are they going to have to do, might they drop it all together or change the very nature of it because it will be less necessary?
It won't be less necessary. It'll still be as critical, because obviously you just want to be as, you want to lower the drag as much as possible when you can. But when it comes to the overall sort of performance strategy, it will change ever so slightly, because they will be more mechanically dependent, mechanical grip, that is, because they don't have that quite as sophisticated aerodynamics, especially on the back of the car. So you'll see them straighten up, probably straighten up a little bit earlier than they did in previous seasons, not being able to carry wide and then just stay on that wide line quite as much as they did before. So it'll be a little bit more point and shoot, I imagine, if the car's dramatically out of the window, but they will claw back most of the potential of the car by using diffuser designs and things like that, the back of the car, to get it to behave itself again.
Fascinating. I am looking forward to getting you back into the shed and taking us through exactly what to expect from the 2021 regulations. It can get confusing when they announce regulations, you know, ahead of time. A lot of the chat we've had today has been 2022 regulations, and you forget that 2021 is just muscling in there saying, hey, you know, me too as well. And of course, it got confusing when they delayed the regulations because of COVID restrictions and all that kind of thing too. So hopefully you'll sit there and unpack it for us sometime in February. Where can people catch up with you online? It's Race Car Engineering on Twitter, search for that. But where are you, Stuart? Where do you hide out online?
I hide out very well under stu.mitch under pretty much every platform that I have. If you guys want to hear my random babblings, then feel free to follow me.
I do want to hear that. Stu.mitch, thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you, guys.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Absolutely fascinating engineering chat from Stuart Mitchell there. Hopefully we'll get him back very, very soon so I can get my head around exactly what's happening with those 2021 regs. But more pressing things are happening in the news cycle. Tracks are starting to be announced. Tracks are starting to be cancelled left, right and centre already. We don't know when the season's going to start. People are already talking about April, and it makes you wonder how those tracks are going to survive. We also are finding out a little bit more about Sergio Perez's contract at Red Bull. Seems like definitely only 1 year. And of course, everyone is speculating about whether Sir Lewis Hamilton will in fact be staying in Formula One. To help us solve all those mysteries is Peter Wright from Digital Law UK. Peter, thank you for taking the time to speak to us in our little shed.
Not at all. Great to be back. And hello, everyone. And I just wanted to start off by saying, you guys have done a fantastic job this year. You really, really have. Earlier in 2020, when I was literally starting to lose my mind with no Formula One, you guys were still there churning out loads of content. And then the race reviews last year were absolutely spot on. So thank you to the whole team. I think you've been a lifesaver for all Formula One fans.
Oh,
you really have.
Oh, Peter, that is absolutely delightful to hear that from you. Matt is still with us on the panel, of course. And you'll remember, Matt, that sinking feeling having just done like 4 solid months of off-season content to go, OK, let's do another off-season.
Let's just do it all again. It worked the first time. What could possibly go wrong?
And then at the beginning of last season, you jumped on as part of that off-season content as well, Peter, because we should be clear here. It's not like you've got spies in the Mercedes camp or the Red Bull camp, but you do give us a good breakdown of contract law and what's happening with these guys. And wild speculation from an educated source such as you, totally fine for us. In fact, it's more legitimacy than we deserve.
Indeed. So what we're going to talk about today, obviously I haven't seen Lewis's draft contract or anything like that, but it's just the benefit of the experience in seeing how these things are very often negotiated. You look at some of the we're going to do some speculation today, but some of the wild uninformed speculation in the press, I think at the moment, really doesn't help if we look at some publications.
Okay, so let's start with Lewis Hamilton's contract. Sir Lewis Hamilton, I beg your pardon. My feeling is that he is going to sign. It feels like Mercedes are all set up for a Lewis Hamilton, Valtteri Bottas setup. They're continuing with their black livery, which is in support of increasing diversity in motorsport and within their organization. Everything feels like it's Lewis Hamilton centric. So what are the potential holdups? Because, well, we're used to those negotiations going deep into a season with Lewis Hamilton. I don't think it's ever gone into the off season before, and certainly, you know, we're now getting liveries and testing liveries. What potential holdups could we be looking at, Peter?
Well, first of all, I think the fact that this is almost the 11th hour. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that drivers would sign a deal not for the year coming, but for the following year. So you'd sort of sign a deal now in 2021 for 2022. So the fact that we're only a matter of weeks from the start of the season and he's got no deal is a bit of a concern. It's not unheard of. Let's not forget that in 1993, Ayrton Senna turned up at the first race of the season with no deal with McLaren and then just proceeded to work on a race-by-race basis for most of the year, getting $1 million a year. I don't think that's going to be the situation with Lewis, but for anyone out there who's starting to sort of gnaw their fingers to the bone thinking there's no contract, I think there is an agree. It almost looks like, as far as Lewis and Mercedes are concerned, do they want to race this year? Of course they do. And I don't think there's any, I would be surprised if, for example, money is a factor at this point. I think it's more going to be the duration of the contract. Is it going to be 1 year, 2 years? He's always had 3 years in the past. I've read some speculation this week saying, oh, it's a 1 year that they've offered. Very often you open with an offer knowing that you have a red line. So it could be that Mercedes is thinking 2 years. I mean, it could well be that Lewis is looking and thinking, actually, do I want 3 years or not? I mean, that will be one major issue, I think, is just the full on term. How long is this going to run? I think the other thing that might well be tied up here, and which this could be a sticking point and could be a reason why it's difficult for them to actually get through this, could be more around issues with regards to intellectual property. let's not forget that Lewis is starting to get involved in an awful lot of things away from the track. So, you know, when Lewis signed his first contract, it was just to race cars as fast as he possibly could, and that was as far as it was really going to go. Now he is a brand. You know, he's got interests in the music industry, in fashion, and it comes down to it. There's the element of the use of his name, the use of branding, what may or may not appear on his race overalls. You know, he might be saying, look, I want to promote XYZ on my overalls. And that was, for example, again, a major issue 20 years ago with Ayrton Senna. His ex-manager did a very interesting interview last year where he was saying that that was groundbreaking, the deal he did with Banco Nacional back in the mid-90s, because, of course, Ayrton had different overalls, if you look at the photos, compared to his teammates. So it could be that there are issues there with regards to that sort of element of IP, and I can imagine that that would be a more difficult nut to crack by far.
Well, you're talking about Lewis Hamilton and Ayrton Senna, arguably among the very most marketable F1 drivers in history, certainly as far as kind of fame goes. So this kind of delay, whilst unusual, we think it's the kind of scale of megastar brand that Lewis Hamilton is bringing makes this unusually complicated. So, you know, we don't need to panic too much as Hamfosi, as some of the panel are, that these things aren't happening. I love the prospect of them just getting to, say, winter testing and going, well, we don't have a contract. We also don't have another driver lined up because we're still talking. So that prospect of like a Lewis Hamilton with no contract just going, well, I'll just do the winter testing, gives a tenner. I like that.
Cash in hand.
Yeah, cash in hand. So, okay, well, let's talk about the negotiations. So from Lewis Hamilton's point of view, there's kind of a big sports star mentality. You know, you look at the basketball stars, the NFL stars. It's not a case of wanting money. A lot of the time, it's about just having their value appreciated. So there might be an element of, well, he's saying, I'm a 7-time world champion now. That has to come with an increase of some sort, because I'm now statistically the most successful driver of all time. You know, could that be a sticking point? Because you've then got Mercedes going, yeah, but we've got to make a bunch of redundancies for the new regulations and the wage caps.
Absolutely right. So I think there's issues certainly probably with regards to that sort of recognition, his status. And I think that could indeed actually be tied up with the future direction of the team just generally. Now, this actually, I think, potentially comes into a few of the issues at the end of the season for Mercedes, where, of course, George Russell jumps into the car, does very, very well. That coincided with Valtteri Bottas having a poorer weekend, and indeed a poor end of the season, I think it's fair to say. And a lot of speculation that he's now on the last year of his deal. So it could be that you're looking at a new driver coming into the team, be it George Russell, be it Esteban Ocon. And then it could be that Lewis might be saying, well, look, as the established lead driver here, I want to have a say on how and when that happens.
Ooh.
And I can imagine Mercedes turning around saying, well, no, that's something that actually we reserve as to the team to make those decisions, and it's not really going to be anything that you're going to have influence on. But we know that drivers can get a little bit upset over this. Let's not forget, you know, would Michael Schumacher have left Ferrari were it not for Kimi Raikkonen being signed and in the way in the wings? The potential arrival of new teammates. Again, Alain Prost arriving at Williams in 1993 was enough for Nigel Mansell to say, I'm not having him as a teammate. So, you know, that element can be quite, in terms of drivers and them feeling that, look, I've been here a long time and I want to have this input, means that they feel there is a bit of a clash. And you can imagine that being a fairly major stumbling block, because there will be a change, I think, at Mercedes in the next couple of years.
Matt?
Yeah. Well, I find this interesting because I'm recalling that when Hamilton left McLaren, one of the biggest issues, which it almost seemed like a joke, but it wasn't, was that he wanted to be able to keep the trophies that he won on the track. And that turned out to be certainly a piece of the puzzle that led him to moving to Mercedes when he did. But I'm going to ask in more general terms, I mean, you've been involved with a lot of these sorts of negotiations. Where are we in terms of absolute brinksmanship here? I mean, is this like the top 1% of brinksmanship you've seen deals of this size? Or are we actually just like, oh, you know, this is like 75%. We got way long to go before it gets to be really serious card playing.
I mean, that's a good question. I think if we can compare that broader to like all sport as well, like in the context of all sport, would this be rare or weird?
Well, you know, even just looking at the general negotiation, what tends to happen with contracts and negotiations full stop, you tend to find that negotiations will draw on and on and on until there is something that means you have to then come to a deal. And we just saw an excellent example of this with the incredibly hurried trade deal announced between the European Union and the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that that deal was announced was because there was a ticking clock.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not go into issues around this, of the whys and the wherefores of this. But the whole point is the reason why you got that 11th hour deal was because you had to have something in place come the 31st of December. Now, in this instance, the ticking clock is the start of the season, and both sides are using that for their own purposes. And that is going to be the thing that there will come a point where, you know, as the drivers are leaving for Australia, that's going to be pretty much the tipping point. Yeah, I think things will have been a little bit unbalanced by the fact that, you know, in this negotiation, there are two very competent Mercedes young drivers stood there in the wings. I'm not by any means saying that either of them could suddenly find themselves in the car. It's just that when it comes to negotiation, that will be a factor, not necessarily for 2021, but for 2022, 2023. Other teams, like McLaren, don't have a young driver scheme where you've got that level of pressure, but Mercedes does. And I think that development over the years of having those young drivers is now coming to bear when it comes to the two current drivers.
Right. You mentioned a ticking clock, but you also said earlier that Senna drove for almost a year without a contract. I know that, like, for example, in certain rent regulations here in New York, if you don't sign a new lease, the old lease is presumed to continue on a month-to-month or a six-month basis, depending, like, I don't know the actual laws regarding it. But is it a similar thing with the driver contract? If they don't come to an agreement, could he just show up and continue on his old contract on a race-by-race basis until they get it done? Or is it full? Or is that just going to be his choice? Full stop. If I don't have a contract, I'm not showing up.
I think that happens with football, isn't it? There's a fullback where there's just a basic salary.
Yeah, I mean, that might be the case. But in a deal like this, I would anticipate it would be fixed term. Mm. So i.e. very clearly for specific seasons and then specific terms relevant to those specific seasons. I should add as well, actually, just thinking about it, and I meant to bring this up earlier on, there will be other issues that, while they might seem ancillary, are actually, I think, for Lewis, very, very important. One of which is, for example, media days. How often he has to turn up you know, do something promotional with the press. His personal time, increasingly, is very, very valuable to him. And not necessarily from the point of view that, oh, I want to go and do my own thing. It's because he knows he needs to take time to recharge, do his own thing. His race preparation, he has demonstrated sometimes, like a few years ago when he ducked out of that F1 promotional event, so he could take his own time to prepare for Silverstone. He turned up at Silverstone, he won the race, he got his championship back on track. So, you know, he wants to have the time to prepare and be a Formula One driver in the way that he has found in recent years works for him. And that means not, you know, necessarily turning up to the opening of a packet of crisps for a sponsor.
Right. So I did want to get your opinion on one more thing. You mentioned that the young drivers are putting a bit of pressure on Lewis's side. But I'm going to ask, in your opinion, he's got the when is the next time you're going to have a chance to have someone win eight World Driver Championships on your mark, especially if the regulations change in 22? We don't know exactly who. I mean, we suspect Mercedes is pretty far ahead, but we don't know. There's no guarantees when you get that kind of a regulation change that the sort of dominance they've enjoyed during these regulations will continue. So how big of a factor is that on Hamilton's side of the equation? And from a marketing point of view, how could you turn that down, no matter what he's asking?
That's a good question, and it is a unique opportunity. I mean, if the media reports are to be believed, the fact that a one-year deal has been tabled, I think, also plays into the fact you have that big regulatory change. It will be, I think, playing on his mind as well that, you know, this is going to be the last major deal that Lewis Hamilton signs. I think that, you know, Kimi Raikkonen is showing that the lifespan of an F1 driver is now significantly longer than it used to be. You can be in your prime, still highly competitive, into your fourth decade. I don't think that's in question. But the point is, as far as Lewis is concerned, that if he were hypothetically ever to continue changing now, I think it has shown that to be a top flight challenging for championship driver, it takes a few years to get there. New engineer, new team, new setup. You can't, it's not like 30 years ago, you know, you put an Ayrton Senna on Alan Prost, change team and suddenly bang, they're winning titles and championships. You know, it does take a few years to get up and running. And therefore, the only realistic place where Lewis is going to win races and championships is Mercedes. And therefore, it becomes almost a marriage of convenience between the two if Mercedes wishes to continue its dominance as well.
I'm wary of people overplaying the threat of the young drivers coming through. I mean, Mercedes themselves have talked about how it's Lewis Hamilton's absolutely brutal consistency that helps them to develop a car. And Valtteri Bottas himself, when asked, you know, what is the difference between you and Lewis Hamilton, he himself has openly said it's the fact that he is doing it turn after turn, lap after lap, race after race. He's brutally consistent. Just because George Russell is fast and performed well at the Shakir Grand Prix says nothing to your season-long performance. Sebastian Vettel is fast, but look at 2017, 2018. He just lacked that edge of consistency, and that ended up losing championships to Lewis Hamilton. So I think whilst Mercedes might be playing their hand to the best of their ability and letting the negotiations go on because they know they've got options, you've got to think Mercedes they're not aggressively pushing him out of the door. Like, we heard reports that Ferrari essentially offered Sebastian Vettel an insulting contract, but maybe with a number two status, and forced him to move. I don't think we've got this situation where we've got Mercedes laying something on to make him go, well, then I'll just retire.
No, I think in the context here, I'm very much thinking of the element of the young drivers coming to play in 2022, 2023. And it's in terms of who might be alongside Lewis. And that's where I'm sort of thinking here, because we know, as I say, a very well-developed Mercedes young driver program, bit of a queue. I mean, it's incredible when you think about it. I don't think we've ever had a front-running team like Mercedes thinking about its succession planning and knowing and having already signed up its next two drivers racing on the grid. And we all pretty much know that that's exactly the case. You know, there was never an element of succession with Williams or McLaren or Ferrari when they were top dog, but Mercedes has been there for so long. And I think it says an awful lot about Toto Wolff as a manager that they have built this program and have, you know, established top flight drivers, these two in Formula One that will come through, and more established throughout the lower Formula as well. And that technical regulations permitting, they're already showing that from the driver perspective, they're thinking about the crucial elements of the driver to stay a force for a long time to come.
I think what we found in the last couple of decades is the best teams with the most funding adapt better to the regulation changes. So I think those hoping for a quick demise of Mercedes' fortunes are probably in for a disappointment. Obviously, in the short term, Lewis Hamilton can't win his eighth world title next season, so he needs to be around for at least 2 years, because next season is the season of Sergio Perez finally winning his first world championship with Red Bull. I think that's a good place to skip to next. Stop laughing. Hey, stop mocking me. I can hope, can't I? It's a really interesting deal. Because my feeling, in all seriousness, Peter, is that Sergio Perez is there to do a very specific job. He is there to be in the pit window of Mercedes, to make things difficult, to support Max Verstappen and be a clear number two. Like, there will be team orders to let Max through if there's any kind of hold up. I've no doubt about that. Would you think that Perez probably knows this? If you know you've got a 1 year contract, and I'm speculating a little bit, do we know that? If you know you've got a 1 year contract, you can take some stuff on the chin, can't you?
Yes. I mean, I forget where I heard it, but I think my understanding is it's a 1 year deal and that he already had a drive confirmed for 2022.
Oh, okay.
So therefore, it was very much this is just a stopgap for 12 months so that he stays on the grid. In terms of performance clauses, and is he a definite sort of number two? Will we hear the Max is faster than you on the pit to car radio? Mm. I would anticipate that it is very much a supporting role, but I think we have to be very clear that in 2022, Honda are looking at seeing, in the last year of their engagement in Formula One, after a very arduous period since they came in 2015, they are looking to see if they can win the title. And therefore, signing Sergio Perez to try and contribute the points to both support a push for the Constructors' Championship, but also so that, I mean, how often did we see this year the two Mercedes in the distance, Max is there 15, 20 seconds back, coming up to the first stops. They're wanting to have another car, another Red Bull in that gap between Max and the rest of the top of the midfield, so that you can then pull the strategy tricks that we know Red Bull like to do, aggressive early strategies,
yeah,
trying to put the pressure onto Mercedes. And they simply weren't able to do that on a regular enough basis in the last season. So that's where this is coming from, and that's why they've brought him into the team.
Oh, Matt, I can see quite a lot of, right, Perez, either dip in early, because we know you can get those tyres to the end of the race, and then pull Mercedes into something they don't want to do, or have him sitting, you know, covering off, not minding an undercut, and just going, you know, three quarters of the race distance, and just, again, just being a wrecking ball. Sorry, Matt, you had a question for Peter.
Well, it wasn't so much a question as an observation along those lines. Is I'm just curious, if you had put Red Bull's second car behind Max in every single race, I'm just curious what the constructors would have actually looked like, because it seemed like to me, especially at the end of the year, we had Valtteri finishing multiple places behind Hamilton on more than a few occasions. And I really think that's why he's there. In the races, he's very consistent. He can make overtakes when necessary. And I think they're really looking for someone to finish that place behind Max every time.
But from a contract point of view, Peter, I don't think we've seen this kind of utility player signing in a top F1 team for a while. That's going to limit Perez from a team point of view. You know, he's not necessarily going to be top table, maybe not at all the engineering meetings.
I'd query that, because I mean, very often when you're putting together your two drivers, you're looking for the right mix. You're looking, whether it might not be on the face of it, you're still wanting someone in that sort of role where you know you can send them both out and they're both going to get maximum points. Sometimes you may have a predetermined idea of what that order should be, a la Ferrari. Sometimes you're just looking to let them go out and race, which is more the Mercedes way. But in order to do that, they're going to need equal access to the, certainly you'd want them to have equipment, but where that isn't the case, you'd certainly want them to have access to as much technical information as possible. But in this instance, where it's only 12 months, albeit at the sort of the cigarette end of Honda's involvement, it's not as though Sergio can take engine secrets from Honda that are going to be of particular value in the years coming. But there may be that element where he's very much involved in the pre-season and the development and bringing updates, but you can imagine that might then taper off mid-season onwards, quite possibly.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think it is kind of standard that when drivers leave, their access to certain technical information gets limited. But it was interesting to me, like in the past season, if I'm not mistaken, Vettel, I think, was axed out of the meetings almost immediately once they announced he wasn't continuing. But at Renault, with Ricciardo leaving, they did the dead opposite. They said, nope, he's fully involved. We're not going to keep anything from him, because we need him to make our team function at the best level possible. It's an interesting calculus to think about, especially because we don't know where Perez has signed his next deal for yet, do we?
It is a good segue, because I thought it might be helpful just to do a little, and this is, I should emphasize here, entirely blind speculation. But I think it's quite interesting to do a process of elimination in terms of, well, where do we think that Perez could be going in 2022? And feel free to play along with this at home, but let's walk through it. Is he going to go to Ferrari? No, they're locked up. We know what their plans are for the coming years. Is he going to go to McLaren? Well, he's not going to go back there, is he? I don't think after 2013. Obviously, Red Bull, it is a 1-year deal. So that door is open now, but probably closed. And clearly they'd be wanting to bring in, probably jumping back to their young driver
program in the future. Maybe Sonoda or Gasly, yeah.
Exactly. There's a very clear staircase of talent there, which they're hoping to bring back on stream. And then you think, well, is he going to go to a smaller team? Would he have jumped to say, I ain't going to go to Toro Rosso or AlphaTauri. I know that's I've been listening to Mr. Apex for so long, I'm still calling him that.
I resemble that remark. Yeah.
And I couldn't really see him going to Alpha. But also, I don't think he'd want to go further down the grid. I think he's just become a race winner. He's been one of the most consistent, bankable drivers on the grid. And that drew me to the conclusion, I think there's only one possible place he would be going to, and I wonder if you agree.
Well, you've got to think some new investment, Williams be the leader of the team with alongside Latifi if he still wants to be there, and assuming that George Russell has then gone and replaced Valtteri Bottas. That was my initial working theory.
Well, I deliberately left out one particular team there from the analysis. And
Alpine. That would be a juicy prospect, I think.
Particularly if they know that at some point Esteban Ocon is going to be getting the call up from Mercedes, if we understand that to be the case. And certainly from my listening to Mr. Apex and your contributors, that's what I understand to be the case. So we've got George and Esteban are there. They are future Mercedes drivers at some point, yet to be determined in the future, but probably one of them going in 2022. That could quite conceivably open up the door to there being then a space at Alpine alongside Fernando Alonso.
Oh, I will be all in on Alpine then. Oh my goodness. I like me a bit of a fiery Fernando Alonso. Obviously, we know I'm a Perez stan. I think I might be all in for Alpine in 2022, Matt. That could be. You think I'm intolerable now? Oh, yeah. You wait.
I'm marveling at the gymnastics required for you to suddenly support this team that you have slated over the years.
I have never, ever said a bad word against Alpine. How dare you? That is, Peter, you're a lawyer. I could sue for that, couldn't I? I'm pretty sure I could. Peter Wright, Digital Law UK, you don't need plugging from us, I'm sure. No one in our audience could afford your extortionate but well-valuable hourly rate, I'm sure. I think you told me once, and I nearly just cried at the numbers. And said, why aren't I a fancy lawyer? But it is a Digital Law UK is your firm. Is that correct?
It is. Digital Law, actually. Digital Law UK is the website, but our brand is Digital Law. And we do advice around law and technology, which is a very interesting area. I was actually on a webinar yesterday where lawyers were actually saying this is an incredibly fast-moving area compared to, say, buying and selling of houses, because it's changing all the time. There's currently a lot of changes due to that Brexit deal we were talking about in terms of data transfers. And actually, one of the things that I do actually as well is I now do a podcast, a digital law podcast each week. So for those Mr. Apex listeners are out there, and I know there's one who listens to my podcast and he listens to Mr. Apex. If any of you are interested in things with regards to data, cybersecurity, e-commerce, the sale of things, goods and services on websites. You know, there's lots of things happening every week there. No shortage of content, believe me.
Peter Wright, Digital Law UK website, Digital Law, the company. I'll get it eventually. Thank you so much for your time. Well, Matt, that was an interesting series of interviews. I thought now would be a good time for some listener feedback.
I think I can only agree with you, sadly, as far as the show is concerned.
Yes, because it would be very awkward to change our plans now. But we've had lovely feedback from our listeners. It isn't all just horrible YouTube comments. Not all. We get a lot of lovely comments. And doing these pre-records gives us an opportunity to go and filter through some of them. So if you don't want to hear us just talking about these feedbacks, that's fine. We'll see you next Sunday, where I believe we'll be talking to Joe Saywood in the shed on Sunday. Not live, that'll be a pre-record as well. Not all of these are just, hey, you guys are brilliant. Some of them have got topics attached to them as well. But I'm going to start with one that is at least vaguely complimentary from Ryan Copeland, who says, I loved the latest podcast with Mr. Carter. This is how long it takes me to get around to these emails, Matt, because he hasn't been on for a while. We'll have to ask Matthew Carter to come on, actually. We'll give him a nudge and see if he wants to come and talk to us again. But I have to say, with the emails, I get a little bit overwhelmed sometimes. I put a star in them, but I feel like once I read them, if I don't immediately respond, then I'm not going to respond. So I delay opening them, and then I end up with this backlog. But I love the latest podcast with Mr. Carter. Says Ryan, you mentioned something that I've been complaining about recently when you brought up the issue of pay drivers and the 2021 grid perhaps being the weakest that we've seen for a while. And I stand by that, Ryan. At what point does Formula One cease to be a sport? Every sport that I can think of is the purest form of meritocracy that we have as a society today. Football, basketball, baseball, filled with athletes that come from absolutely nothing yet achieve greatness. It goes on a bit, but let's just address those points. And thank you very much for your email, Ryan. Now then, it should be said that with other sports, it isn't entirely a meritocracy. I know we'd love to have that dream that literally any kid can rise to the top of any sport. But at some point, you do have an advantage by being well connected in sport. You know, it's not a coincidence that both England striker, I'm forgetting names now, Peter Wright. Have I got that right? Ian Wright, who's a pundit, you know, for sport. Why did I say Peter Wright? Because we've been speaking to Peter Wright. So yep. Ian Wright, England striker, both his adopted children or like, you know, stepchildren through marriage became professional footballers. Now, they're both very good, but tell me they didn't have the same, you know, better access to agents, to coaches and be put in front of the right people. So before we sort of paint F1 as being the only non-meritocracy, it does happen in other sports as well.
Yeah, and looking at the rest of the email and the fact that he mentions NBA and NFL, I think you may be talking about the wrong kind of football here, my friend.
Oh yes, soccer. Beg your pardon, soccer. So in F1, obviously that is exaggerated, but I just wanted to make the point that in all sports, you know, if you have access to better coaches, to better conditions, to better equipment, like cycling is possibly still, you could paint that as a very middle class sport because you need access to, you know, decent equipment. Maybe swimming falls into that category as well. I'm spitballing a little bit. With F1, I think we are at a tipping point. It does feel like this problem that everyone, it's always existed. And they say, Niki Lauda, he was a pay driver. I do think we are entering a different kind of pay driver era.
You know, I had thought about that when you originally read it to me. I would like to amend it to not so much that it ceased being a meritocracy, but that your skill in bringing money to the sport has never been more important in securing a place on the grid, especially in the midfield. And I know you want to say it's the weakest ever. I mean,
no, I didn't say weakest ever. For a while. It's the weakest grid for a while, undoubtedly.
I don't know. I mean, because you have Hamilton and Verstappen, you have a lot of very, very, very good drivers in this field. There's a percentage of the drivers that are there more because of their ability to bring money than their ability to bring driving, or because they are in that flux zone where they can definitely bring the money and they might have the talent. You don't really know. So why not take the money in the meantime? Because the money from the driver is guaranteed. The money from championship points is not. And it's that fundamental financial structure of Formula One that we've inherited from the Bernie era. Mm. Once the sponsorships of individual teams collapsed, it's that fundamental structure that still needs tweaking so that they can go and find the Ocons, they can find the Hamiltons and the yet to be discovered, and the teams can afford to bring them up through their talent ladders and afford to sponsor them in F2 and F3 and other forms of sport that prepare you for your shot at the big leagues, so to speak.
The super license system kind of helps, because what it means is even drivers who we don't rate as being meritocratical, let's use Lance Stroll as an example. At least Lance Stroll has had to get up to a basic standard where he is not like the pay drivers of old, who are like, you know, seconds off the pace. He's up there. He can do the job. I just would argue that he's not, you know, at the level of Sebastian Vettel, Lewis Hamilton, and Esteban Ocon, Daniel Ricciardo, and probably isn't going to be. But he's been good enough to get through with advantages, with extra training, with extra resources and additional chances. So I think that there's a good chance that the standard Lance Stroll drives to is probably world beating if you put him, you know, compared to drivers 40 years ago, which everyone is going to hate. But that's how high the standard is in general. So the super license helps with that. But we could take that further and say, well, actually, let's use the feeder series to not only say super license points to qualify, but actually you've got to have finished in the top four of lots of series or something, you know, so there's some kind of league promotion system, which F2's not quite filling right now. The key difference in my scenario would be you can't have paid drivers in F1. So you make it in F1 so that there is some skew that the points and that the money and the points is not from the drivers. So therefore there's an incentive for the teams to pick up the best drivers. And even if they've managed to pay their way all the way up to F2, they're still not going to be picked up by an F1 team if they can't deliver the lap time.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the theoretical construct of the idea. The fact that you have to win starting maybe in, like, I don't know if there's an F4, but you have to win a regional champ. Like, once you get above regional racing, once you get to F3 or F2, you have to finish in the top three of a championship in order to qualify to race in Formula One. But the teams will never have that. Mm. They'll vote it down because they want flexibility to bring in someone from Super Formula or someone from this or someone from that. And they also need to be able to farm out these drives to other drivers to make money on practice sessions. Most of them do. Obviously, your Mercedes and your Red Bulls, not so much. But once you get down the grid, and finally, like, I love the idea, no pay drivers, but okay, I'm going to tell you right now, then Mazepin's not a pay driver. He just comes with a personal sponsor that pays $40 million a year to be on his overalls and a Haas. Okay, so he's not a pay driver, but his sponsor effectively is just a third-party cutout to him being a pay driver. That's going to be a real difficult problem to deal with, what I mean?
Yeah, and of course, people like Lance Stroll and Latifi, presumably, they have won championships on the way up. But they've managed to leverage advantages in those areas as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, and we could talk a little bit about F2 because F2 was originally intended to be a series that you only spent a year or two in.
Hmm.
And now there are people who are veterans of F2 because if you win it, you can't come back and race in it. But if you finish second or third, you can keep on coming back and keep on coming back. And I think when people talk about the unfairness of Stroll, it's as you said, I don't think he's on a Ricciardo or Ocon level or Hamilton, etc. But on a good day, he is there or thereabouts. But what I think where your point is most apt is the fact that he was given all the time and support in the world to reach that developmentally.
Mm.
And young drivers coming in today, Tsunoda, Albon, Gasly, who don't have that support. Well, how long did Albon get?
Yeah.
That was two years?
Yeah.
Yeah, and done.
I was thinking out loud earlier when I was talking about my promotion relegation system. I got a bit confused there because, it's not the winning of the titles on the way up that is necessarily the factor. It's what makes the F1 team select you. And there needs to be some kind of incentive for F1 teams to pick the best driver. Right now, the incentive is to pick up the funding.
Yeah. So in the ladder to Indy, you can start at a driver school, win, get on the lowest rung of the ladder with sponsorship, win, move up to the next rung of ladder with sponsorship. If you win Indy Lights, to my knowledge, unless this has changed, I don't follow Indy as closely as I do Formula One. So sincere apologies if I've misremembered it or they've changed it since I last looked. But if you win Indy Lights, you go to a team the next year with enough sponsorship to fund you for a full season at that team. So ooh, like you full on get your chance paid for by the sponsor at the top level.
Okay, I've got a way to fix what I know I was saying wrong earlier. Here's my chance to fix it. All right, make F2 also a series where you can't just buy your way in. So to get into F2, you have to win F3. I think that buffer there would, you have to move the pay competition down two levels to be able to give you a little bit of a buffer. Because you might be able to buy your way up to F3, for example, but if you've then got an F2, which is only made up of people who have scored enough points in lower series, then you're going to get a meritocracy feeder series, a truly meritocracy feeder series, for the F1 people to really have a good look and maybe even draft the drivers like they do in the NFL.
Yeah, no, a draft with sponsors would be the ideal thing, but you have the same problem in F2. F2 is cheap compared to F1, but it is not cheap by any other standard.
All right. Well, look, that wasn't the best argument I've ever made. Don't be too mean in the comments, but do feel free to correct me. But look, when we get comments and stuff on YouTube and people complain sometimes if they get moderated, that's because there's a difference between, hey, I think you got that point wrong, and here's what I might have said, and, oh my God, you're such a knobhead. Why'd you do that? You're the worst. If it leads with that, we are probably going to moderate those comments a little bit in the YouTube comments and on the live chat. But please don't mistake that for not wanting debate. We absolutely love debate. Help us form this argument. And a lot of times we take on feedback we get where we've got things wrong, and we love that. We appreciate it. That's one of the best things about the live chat, is they can correct us in real time.
Yeah, it is. And it's an important thing to understand. Like, when you make a comment and it gets moderated, it's because we are not just sitting here talking about a subject. Mm. We're sitting here doing 9 other things simultaneously. And if you are disturbing our balance, our equilibrium, then we will give you a timeout. But don't take it as personally as we hate you and we hate your feedback and we never want to hear from you. Just understand that at that moment, that was the straw that was going to break what, the camel's back?
Yeah,
and the production process.
Yeah, and also I get a bit defensive if people insult the panel at all. So I love the live chat. If you come in there and like comment on negatively on someone's physical appearance, I'm probably just gonna swing a banhammer. And we have mods there who help look after us. I love the energy of the live chat, Matt, but I've come to a slight change in approach in that last week when we had live stream problems. Turns out it was at YouTube's end, we think. A lot of names in the live chat that we don't normally hear from were suddenly very, very angry at us for not being able to provide the live stream that we normally could. And, not particularly nice about it, not particularly sympathetic. And it was very stressful. And we can take that stress every now and then. But what I realized is, actually, as great as the live chat is, that big energy, all out live, open to anyone affair, actually does take a toll, and I do occasionally need a little bit of a break from that. So whilst we're going to keep the vast majority of the streams we do completely open to everyone, and definitely all the race reviews, I'm going to have a few more patron-only ones, because those people are invested in the show and they're less likely to just sit there and kind of heckle from the back. However, I'm really trying hard to not make it a paywall, so what I'm going to do on the Patreon is introduce a one penny a month tier that means that you will access all the live streams. It's just that small bit of emotional investment to say, right, at least if you went to the effort of going to patreon.com/MissedApex, then maybe you're less likely to do that, just so that you can echo from the sidelines.
You're less likely to show up randomly and give us a hard time about a thing.
Yeah, so I'm not saying by any means it won't even be like half the streams. We're just going to move some more of the streams to being patron only, just to give us a bit of breathing space. But like I said, one penny tier, patreon.com/MissedApex. The one penny tier will be the all access live stream pass. You'll get a link sent to you every single week. Ian says, hey Spanners, my name is Ian. I tune in from Montreal, Canada. Hello, Montreal, eh? You guys had mentioned you're planning on coming here for the Grand Prix next year. I'd be happy to help the team out with planning, navigation of the city, and anything else you might need. What a lovely, lovely offer. You've also mentioned on numerous occasions how you took a break from engineering and focused on building Missed Apex. I've been thinking of a career change myself. Can I pick your brains? You absolutely can, Ian. And by the way, if you email us, there is a strong chance it will get read out. So apologies if I was not meant to read that out. But yes, pick my brains. Absolutely. And I do hope there's a Canadian Grand Prix for us to go to.
Yeah, well, and maybe not read his last name if you're going to read out his planning to career change. I mean, I sincerely doubt that his job will find out through that.
Oh, okay, but let's add a beep. There'll be a beep in there.
What amazes me most is that you have read the entire email except for the last line, which says that he listens to Tech Time. How is it possible you skipped that?
I cannot even see that line. I just want to correct one thing, though, because in case this is a misconception. Unfortunately, no, I wasn't able to leave a stable engineering job to do an F1 podcast full time. I wish it had worked out like that. It's a little bit more complicated than that. So skip forward 2 minutes if you don't care. What happened was, I think it was sometime in 2018, is that I had opportunities to go and do a bunch of cover shifts on radio. And I knew it was always going to be a kind of temporary thing. I had my weekly show, but I kept being asked to fill in for various presenters just while there was a changing of the guard, if you like, and there were some spanner-shaped gaps for me to go into. But it turned out that they were just a little more than I could handle, because I was like, okay, I can take a couple of days holiday. Yeah, sure, I can cover for that. Then it turned into a week. And before I knew it, I was like taking all of my like 5-6 weeks leave on doing media work, be it commentary, radio, etc. So I actually had to choose to say no to stuff or take a gamble and just go for it. And I was terrified, Matt, that if I said no to anything, the whole presenting media dream would just get taken away. So I ended up just saying yes to everything and going, right, well, it's now or never, and just diving out of the plane without a parachute, hoping I'd find one on the way down.
Yeah, no, that's the classic freelancer's dilemma, is you always feel like you have to say yes to everything, because the moment you say no, they'll never call you again. They'll call the person who said yes instead. And it's a real thing. And it's one of the most challenging things about having a career that is sort of piecemeal like that.
Yes. And now I very much have a piecemeal career, and I think it paid off, because I have a reasonable relationship with that radio station. They still hire me to come in once a week, and I still get cover shifts like I did over the Christmas holidays as well. So I think that's a gamble that paid off. The wonderful thing about Missed Apex and the fact that we have ad revenue and Patreon support is that for me and Matt, it covers our production hours. We've always been very keen to say the bit where we just talk and go, blah, 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 isn't Formula One great? That still remains as our hobbyist part of it. But there is also a lot of production work and preparation and editing and putting stuff out where our freelance time is covered. And what it means is we very rarely, although Matt will prioritize a gig, and I will prioritize probably if anyone wants to offer me live TV, anyone. What it does mean is that Missed Apex has a place in my freelance calendar. I don't have to go, I can't do Missed Apex this week because I need to get an audiobook out so that we can have food.
Yeah, and to be fair, I would probably prioritize live TV too if anyone offered it to me. They just haven't yet.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with you? Come on.
And so a combination of that, continuing radio, and then the third leg has been just a random assortment of wonderful things where we've got audiobooks coming out. I've done some commentary. I've done consulting. I've put on webinars for people. A mismatch of everything I can find within media to just claw in. So it's like having 20 different tiny little jobs. A buffet. A meze of media work that at the moment, I have to say, yeah, it's going just about survivable, just about all right. In 2020, I only applied for 4 engineering jobs in a wild, sweaty panic. So far, so good. Brilliant. Patreon.com/MissedApex. You'll get an ad-free feed. You can join us in the Slack group. Or what else can you do? Oh, the patron-only content as well. And you'll get, of course, the live stream tiers that we were talking about earlier. Got some wonderful emails from Aaron as well, who said that he has been going back and listening to all our race reviews since 2017.
Wow.
Okay, don't tell anyone what you heard. I'm sure I flip-flopped.
Quite the contrast, I would guess.
I'll bet. Hopefully, Aaron, you found that we've improved steadily. Aaron says, cheers, mate, for the great show and all the best with your future plans for the show. And we've also had a lovely email from David from the Netherlands, who says, especially in these dark days, it's been a real comfort to have a kind voice in your head. And I just wanted to let you know that he said he's been enjoying our show on Spotify. Oh, my show, Spanners 90s Radio, as well. And this is the other tier to our multifaceted freelance work that we do here, is that we want to leave ourselves enough time to throw stuff at the wall. So we also have an iRacing podcast that's come out, Spanners 90s Radio, Remain Indoors, and all sorts of projects that hopefully one of them grabs on to a vine and grows like an ivy up into the sky. Something like that. I think that'll do us for today. Get in touch, spannersready@gmail.com or mattpt55@gmail.com.
Yep, yep, absolutely.
Follow Matt at mattpt55 on Twitter, me at spannersready. We hope you have a wonderful week, and wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.